The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And we are nearing the 90th day of our quarantine here in Colombia and in Bogota, of course. This week, we'll only have another two-segment show, just me at the beginning. And then we're talking to very special guest, a return visitor on Columbia Calling, the author Julian Pacheco, who will be talking about her book, The Ant Hill. Now, I've read this, and it's really well worth a read. A great, I wouldn't say indictment, but it's a search for identity, in my opinion, not only for the main character, the protagonist, Carolina, Lina, in the book, but also the search for identity for Medellin herself. So very interesting. I'd love to hear back from you guys what you think about this book. Of course, she was on many, many months ago, years ago, in fact, talking about her first book, The Lucky Ones, which I believe is based more in Cali. And I've not read it. So this is the week that was here in Colombia. It's been a dreadful week for our vice president. You can look up on the Columbia Calling Facebook page. I've posted a whole bunch of articles referring to what's gone on there. And yes, as I say always, stay safe, stay home, go out as little as you possibly can, talk to friends, heed the warnings, because here in Colombia, the curve is still on the rise. We've had some record days, tragic days, and record deaths for coronavirus. And the UCIs, the ICUs even, UCI in Spanish, but the ICUs are over 54% in Bogota, and the Caribbean coast seems to be absolute chaos as well. So please, please, please heed the warnings. They're for a reason. They're there for a reason. Of course, you can help us. You can help us continue the Columbia Calling podcast, because this is episode 329. We've been going for 7 years. Throw a little bit of cash, from as little as $2 a month, on our Patreon page. So look at patreon.com, Columbia Calling. But if you don't like that, just go to buymeacoffee.com, and there we are as well, Columbia Calling. And you can just give a donation for the cost of a coffee. Or more, a coffee and a croissant, if you like. Anyway, this is episode 329. We'll be talking shortly to Julian Pacheco on the line from Norwich in Great Britain. And then, we've got more people lined up, journalists and authors, for the coming week. So great episodes in the pipeline for all of you. Thank you again for listening, and don't go away. And we're back. This is the final segment of the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 329. And my very special guest is on the line from Norwich. That's in Norfolk in the United Kingdom, Great Britain, or whatever you want to say. Out there, I know it quite well, in fact. But anyway, my very special guest is the author, Julian Pacheco, and she's out there. And we're going to be talking about her recent book. It's just out, hot off the press, called The Ant Hill. Julian was actually on the show back in 2017 in August, and we were talking about her first book there, The Lucky Ones. But now we've got The Ant Hill, and I have to say that I genuinely enjoyed this book. A little bit about Julianne here is she's the author of The Lucky One. She grew up in Cali and lived there until she was 18. She has a PhD in creative writing from UEA, that's the University of East Anglia, where she is now. And she's working as, you know, I guess it's that you're a professor there. Well, welcome back on Columbia Calling. And thank you for agreeing to come back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
No, it's great to be able to follow up. I mean, wow, a couple of years have passed and you've got a new book and it's going to be a roaring success. I finished it this morning. Thank you again for that. And well, you know, the world has changed since we last spoke, but
yes, it has. I'm awful and tell my 2017 self, like, oh, by the way, for your next book in 2020, things are going to be a little different.
Well,
but you know,
it goes. Yeah, and I believe you're there, hunkered down in your home, just out, you know, in the outskirts of Norwich, grading papers.
Yep, it's marking season here, and it might be my last semester as a teacher for a while because my contract expires on the 30th of June, and universities are in a bit of a rut here in the moment at the UK. So we'll see if this is the end of my career as a creative writing instructor. But well, who knows? Like maybe. Maybe there'll be some employment in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you can be virtual and so on. It wouldn't be the same, of course. Well, you know, I mean, maybe this is it. Maybe your time in Norwich is, you know, we're putting a full stop at the end of it now. And there's new, the past is new for you.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely feels like a time of transition and change, which can be a little scary, but I guess it's also exciting. So I don't know. We'll see. Who knows what the future holds, but definitely for now I'm in Norwich for at least the next, you know, couple months.
Yeah,
I
definitely.
Mean, I don't even know if I'm like technically able to like travel anywhere at the moment. I think the UK might still have like a travel ban. I don't know. It's all up in the air.
Yeah, I don't know. If we were to travel there, we'd have the 14-day quarantine somewhere or other.
Yeah.
Probably somewhere like Runnymede, you know, just outside Heathrow or somewhere. But anyway, let's talk about the anthill. And let's talk about, I mean, your twin sister lives in Medellin. You spend a lot of time there. You wrote it, obviously, in Medellin.
Mm-hmm.
It focuses on, let's say, what we would say in English, a shanty town or, you know, an invasion kind of community up there on the hillsides, and you bring into it very much Medellin's forward-looking urban planning and urbanization and the sort of kind of gentrification, the Metrocable, that's the cable car that goes up the side of the mountains. And it deals with Carolina, or Lina, who's coming back to Medellin. She was born there, lived there until she was 8 years old, and then after some tragic instances was taken to the UK, where she's lived ever since. She comes back, and it's, well, for me, the underlying theme, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there's an identity question there, and it's not just Lina, Carolina, it's the city itself in this identity. Where does it fit in? So tell us about how you came to this, and if I'm completely off point.
No, I mean, I'm completely open to readers interpreting the book however they want. So I definitely won't say that you're wrong in that vein. But yeah, I think identifying identity as one of the core themes of the book is very apt. I mean, in a way, the book is a classic quest narrative where you have a character making a journey to find themselves, except in this case, it's not a character traveling somewhere new. They're traveling home, right? Like one of the main characters, Lina, is traveling back to the country of her birth, the city of her birth, Medellin. But in many ways, because she's been away for so long, for 20 years, the city is very different from the Medellin she knew as a child in the 90s. And because my previous book was about Colombia, I wasn't originally going to write about Columbia again. I didn't really know if I had anything else to say about it, but going back to Medellin to visit my sister there and then just seeing the way the city had changed in just the 10 years that my sister's been living there, that had an impact on me. Mm-hmm. And I guess writing fiction is one of the ways I try to just cope with my own, you know, personal development or like personal thought process, or just trying to sort out my own thoughts and feelings. So writing this novel was a way for me to kind of cope with the feelings I had about seeing the changes that were taking place in Medellin and in Colombia overall.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating on that front. And when you talk about sort of, let's say, Lina coming home, there's that moment where she says, you know, to Thomas's grandmother, and she goes, actually, Lina says, I grew up here. And Thomas says, his grandmother says, yes, but you're not from here. And I was like, is this going to happen to my kids? You know, the Anglo-Colombians born up here, but if we take them overseas and they come back, will that be the kind of reception they have?
Yeah, and I think even within Colombia itself, you know, it's a very divided society in terms of class and economics. And that was one of the things I was also interested in exploring, just this idea of the class divide and just like the divisions existing between social classes, because obviously that was something that, you know, was very true of my experience as a child, like growing up in Cali, right? Where like I'm going to, you know, a private school where everyone's being taught English. So it's, and that's obviously like a very different experience from someone growing up in the barrio, like in the hillside neighborhood. So, so that's always a theme that's on my mind, I suppose.
Definitely so. I mean, it's not just a, you know, a nation thing. It's within the cities and the country itself, of course. And yeah. I starting from the beginning, I mean, I've plunged through this book, and I love the development of the character Shauna. I just love it because I can see so many, I don't know, volunteers, or do you want to say voluntourists or so on? I can see so many in her. Did you spend time, and your description of her, of course, is she's from, you know, you sort of say Wisconsin, Michigan, or somewhere, one of those sad, weird middle states is what you described it. you're going to get some kickback there, but I mean, I understand it. And I just thought you must have spent time observing. Did you sit in like cafes in El Poblado, in the sort of gringo fied area of Medellin, and just sort of watch people? Was it like an ethnographic experience?
No, but that's a really interesting suggestion. I kind of regret not trying that. I mean, I used to work in volunteer management and like volunteer development, never in Colombia. I worked in the States. I did some work on the Mexican border. And for a long time, I thought that was going to be my career. And there's still certain elements that I think you can get from volunteering abroad or experiential learning that I think are very valuable. So I wouldn't want to discount that completely. And I still think that like traveling and experiencing other cultures other than your own, learning another language, I think that's one of the most important and valuable things that you can do as a person. But I guess what troubled me, wasn't so much this idea of kind of like snarkily passing judgment on like other people's decisions or how like other people choose to travel. But I do find, you know, the kind of like fetishistic aspects of volunteerism a bit disturbing because I mean, specifically, I find this obsession with the image quite disturbing, this idea of like, well, I want to project a certain image of myself as a good person who's doing good, right? Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's connected to social media, and like people are kind of more concerned with how, you know, people think of you or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I find that kind of distressing, where people want to project this idea of doing good or being good rather than actually being interested in the communities that they're in. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, it's like, on one hand, I think like, you know, I'm not kind of like shaking or like wagging my finger at people and being like, oh, you're like a bad person for like wanting like a nice latte and poblado. It's like, I like a nice latte and poblado, mm-hmm, from time to time, like not. But I think like, and I don't think this is like just true in like Colombia, but I think the fact that travel is so much, I mean, it used to be so much easier, like not anymore. So that would be really interesting, that this book might be like a relic of, you know, a kind of historical time of the way tourism used to work. So that's kind of an interesting thought. But I think because traveling to other countries used to be so easy, you know, I find the idea of just kind of traveling as a way to just collect experiences sort of weird, right? So you're not really interested in learning the history of a place or kind of having like an encounter with the place. You just kind of want to like collect an image of it, right? Just kind of like you're taking off items on a list. And I find that kind of strange and a little bit of like a shallow approach to life. Well, I don't know if that really answered your question.
Absolutely. Because you know, one of the blurbs or one of the write-ups is, of course, this is a, you know, sort of addressing these issues in the Instagram age. And mm-hmm, all of my listeners will know what that is. But I mean, you do, I mean, there's a slew of pages where you clearly describe this around the page 60s and so on. I mean, you talk about a Welsh girl who's saying, I love feeling like I'm in danger. Mm-hmm. And then there's a description of someone saying, the dirty, filthy energy of these countries and their shitty buses, how authentic. And that, for me, is you've put Instagram but into words, mm-hmm, in that, you know, it's like, oh, aren't we taking a risk, or aren't we being great? So you mean you, I don't want to say you unload, but you certainly put it out there that and of course these people, you know, people who come out, and I was very much involved in I hate portmanteaus, mm-hmm, but voluntourism for many years in Ecuador and Peru and Brazil, and so
you know, that was a very formative and important experience that I've had. Mm. Yeah.
And I just think, you know, it can be very good indeed. And it's the way you apply yourself and the way that you are in these communities. Like you said, more investigation and more understanding, more learning of where you are. And what also your presence is doing there as well. I mean, I think that's important. You're not just going in for a 2-week jaunt and then, mm-hmm, coming out with something you can put in your college application letter. You know, it's something else. It's, you are leaving an imprint, and how does that affect this community in your absence? It's very important.
Yeah. And there was one book I read that was really like formative to kind of like some of the thinking behind the book, where it was called Winners Take All, the Elite Charade of Changing the World. Mm-hmm. And kind of like the basic thesis of this book was about how this idea of like philanthropy is actually about trying to like preserve systems of wealth and power. So it's not actually about helping. It's just about projecting the image of helping. So that was a book that was like really influential and really interesting to me, because, you know, my parents worked in like development for like, you know, 30, 40 years. So, you know, I grew up kind of hearing them complain like, oh God, we went to this conference and there was just this like huge expensive buffet. And it's like, why spend money on that? You know, it just seems so wasteful. Mm. So it's obviously like a big complicated theme. And yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like I also like went through this phase where I was just got like really into watching like influencer videos of like these influencers living in Medellin. So there's this one guy who would like go to a park and be like, this is how you can have like a free gym workout and like these like free workout equipment in the park. And you know, it's like my experience of growing up in Colombia as a child was just being told constantly like, oh God, Colombia, it's so dangerous. Like what a dangerous country, you know? And then like when I moved to the US for college, like people telling, you know, when I tell them I grew up in Colombia, their first reaction is like, oh, you grew up there? Like, did your parents smuggle drugs? Yeah. Like, you know, like anyone in the cartel? And so for me, it was like, just such a radical change of like seeing Colombia being treated as this kind of like fashionable, trendy destination. And I think there's good and bad things that come with that, right? I think it's good for local economies. I think it's like good if a form of tourism that emphasizes sustainability and like preserving the environment is good. But, you know, it's also like a concern of just like what a sudden influx of tourists might do culturally. Mm. Right. Yeah. And maybe that's something we'll still have to wait and see what happens. I don't know if like part of me is just, it's hard to see something change and it's hard to deal with change. And I guess that's like the fundamental like feeling behind the book and at the heart of the book, right? Mm. We're sort of my childhood home, you know, this country that I'll always be connected to was changing. And sometimes like change is hard to see. And I don't know if it's a good change or a bad change or like any kind of change always has both good and bad elements. But I guess that's at the heart of the book. That was the feeling I wanted to explore.
I think, when you made a reference to the influencer, I think, are you talking about Zach Boris, who's been there in Medellin? He was on the show.
I have to edit this out because I don't want to like name.
Don't worry. He was on the show. He was on the show some months back. So he's.
I thought he's perfectly fine. It was a very like entertaining sequence and probably like useful and like informative for other people. But yeah, I just find like influencer culture interesting because it emphasizes the visual and like engaging with the visual, like engaging with an image is like very different from engaging with a piece of text.
Yes.
Right. And so because I'm a writer and I work with text that like requires like concentration and like immersion, that's just like something that interests me of like people who have a career that's like dealt with getting people to be interested and like wanting to engage with images as opposed to text or even like audio. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So no shade. I'm not throwing any shade to anyone.
No, it's okay. Indeed. But I like you making the reference to the book that, that obviously, you know, you took a lot of, inspiration from. I was looking through the list of books that you sort of, you know, you've obviously alluded to and then of course listed at the back of your book. And as you mm-hmm. have listed, Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno's book, There Are No Dead Here, A Story mm-hmm. of Murder and Delilah in Colombia. So, I mean, you take one thing and talk about influences and then talk about one of the most sanguine books about Colombia in recent years. I mean, so you're mixing it up, but also keeping the image of Colombia there, the reality of what's going on behind, let's say, this very sanitized influencer or image led culture in which we live at the moment. And I think that takes me to one more of your, when we talk about the social media, there's one more comment that's on there. It's a German volunteer who's expressing, you know, expressing surprise that this great bakery is not even on Google Maps. And mm-hmm. you're capturing it every time with these, they're just, you know, I don't say they're not, for me, principal phrases, but they're the ones that impact. And of course, different phrases, it will impact for other people, but these ones are the ones that jumped out at me. I guess it's, you know, just being a father and seeing how, you know, children adapt to this new technology. It's not new, but it's new for us, I guess. And when you talk about change, when you talk about change and change in the city and change in Colombia, mm-hmm. I think I want to read a quote, because this is a good place to talk about the urban, in inverted commas, transformation of Medellin. And you're not critical of it, but you are certainly ensuring that we know that it's there and it's, you know, a cause of some confusion, I think. And of course, again, identity crisis for Carolina in the book. And this is on page 243, and it's a few lines, but I'll read it out. But Lena stands there alone, papers in her hand, page after page of gaping darkness, of scribbled rage, of a monstrously dark presence that no amount of good cheer and optimistic determination can hide. You can't pretend it didn't happen. You can't pretend that it hasn't been there all along. Urban transformation and the 21st century innovation can't hide it. It can't keep it from seeping in. It's here, it's big, and it's not going away anytime soon. Has it been lurking in the background of this country the entire time? How could she not have seen it? How could she not have known? And still, the anthill children keep heading to the front of the line, mouths moving automatically, repeating the phrase they've seemingly compelled to finish, like they've joined something that they now have to follow through to the very end, whatever that may be. And you talk about it on several occasions. I know that the context is slightly different, but this urban transformation in Medellin has been, of course, key to the city's economy. And of course, let's say to the immigrant expat community moving down there, this kind of location independent individual. And I just see, when I see it, it's like these are two or three Medellins. And we talk about this urban transformation, the world's most innovative city, of course, in an open voting context. You are grappling with this as well, the Colombia of your childhood and now this Medellin. And so tell us a little bit more about this and how you feel about this world's most innovative city.
Yeah, I mean, I guess something that I found interesting while writing this book is, you know, if you just kind of like Google Medellin, the first hits that will come up will typically be written in the same style, the same vein, the kind of like same headline where it emphasizes this transformation, right? Of like, oh, you know, the city that was once dangerous and is no longer. And like, you can't deny that the change has been dramatic and pronounced. But yeah, and I mean, like, in terms of urban transformation, like my sister's partner, he's from Medellin, well, from Bayo more specifically. And he works as an architect. So, and he's designed parks and like public spaces. And so that's been a really important part of his career. But I guess, like, in terms of, I guess I wanted to challenge this, what I saw as sort of like a bit of a cliche in terms of international coverage about Medellin, where it just talks about like this city that's been transformed, that's kind of just starting anew. But I don't think that you can talk about anywhere in that kind of vein or in that kind of style, right? And I mean, I think, like, I mean, this is probably like a bit of a reach and like a bit of a digression, but when you were reading that passage just now, you know, I was just kind of thinking about the current protests for Black Lives Matter, like in the US, and how that's like a really good example of, you know, like the US is like projecting this image of this kind of like stable, equal, welcoming society. And it's like, well, it's not. And you can't hide that, right? So it's like really important for all countries, like not specifically to Colombia, to try to figure out a way to like how to have narratives that aren't kind of shallow or like convenient or kind of just like wrap everything up in like a neat sounding headline, right? Because that that's not like how things work. And like, it seems that for countries and for people, like the way you tell a story is really important for how you make sense of an experience. So, I guess like I was, in terms of like the theme of urban transformation, like when I would just see like headlines from, you know, an English language news outlets of like, oh, Medellin, like such a great city to visit, so different, so fun, like that, it just kind of irked me personally, because it just wasn't really kind of like acknowledging the darkness of its history and like what it's been through. So yeah, I don't know. And I think like fiction is also a good place to kind of explore feelings of ambiguity, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I'm not like writing like an essay or like a thesis about how urban transformation or like gentrification does or does not affect cities like positively or negatively or whatever, right? Like fiction is a place to like explore ambivalence and ambiguity and like emotions. And then readers can, in my view, I think readers should come to their own conclusions about what a book is or isn't saying.
Definitely. There's a, yeah, as you say, there's quite a lot more in what's not said. I mean, you put you put the topic out there, but then we need to do our work on it. And when we talk about sort of needing to know a bit more about Colombia, I kept thinking and reflected on your book, The Ant Hill. I kept thinking, can you come to this without a prior knowledge of Colombia? I think you can. I think you can come to this because I think you can maybe transplant to various places and stories. But there are moments, you know, there are moments where you are really deep into the Colombia context when you're talking about Carolina's mother in the paramilitaries, and then there's a Uribe, and then there's this and that. It's like, some people might need to make references elsewhere to read this. Was this a concern for you when you were writing the book?
Yeah, I mean, obviously writing in English for, you know, an English language publisher for what is primarily going to be like an English language audience. I mean, the book has been translated into Spanish, and I actually think it's going to be published in Colombia any day now. So that's exciting. It got like pushed back because of COVID-19, but then my editor was just texting me yesterday and he was like, it's coming out in a few days. So that was, that was good news. So yes, but obviously writing in English, you know, that's a decision that any writer has to make of how much information or context do you want to give your audience. So yeah, I think what you've said is accurate, that there's some references in the book that probably not everyone will get, but you know, if people are interested, they can kind of Google it themselves, or, you know, I mean, that's why I always kind of like mention the books that really influenced me at the end, because, you know, whenever I finish a book, if the author has listed books that they find helpful, I always, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, now I can add that to my reading list as well. So, yeah, I mean, hopefully, I mean, like the other thing when I was writing this book is that there's a lot of, you know, books kind of set in Bogota, but I couldn't really find any books that were, you know, kind of set in Medellin that weren't, you know, that had been written or like translated in English that were kind of like from this perspective or kind of dealt with these themes of kind of like the young millennial in Medellin. Right. So yeah, I mean, yeah, I've gotten like some feedback from the book of people saying that, oh, you know, I found this really interesting, and like, I've never been to Medellin, but it sounds like a really interesting place. So yeah, you know, I mean, that's always good to hear, I suppose. That's
definitely, definitely good to hear. I liked the descriptions, and I've seen this before and heard it before from friends of mine who've, you know, work in sort of psychosocial help towards children. Mm-hmm. And of course, children are key in the book, and where you've got you know, these descriptions of you and it's Carolina and mm-hmm. Matias playing paramilitaries or playing mm-hmm. guerrillas and playing being kidnapped in the jungle, where it becomes, you know, this violence and what we can't even comprehend, those of us from other parts of the world, let's say UK mm-hmm. or US, it's the norm. And I have, you know people who've worked in the psychosocial help, and they do make reference to this, to children drawing pictures of armed men and so on. Did you get involved in this? Did you spend some time with children, or did you talk to people who are, you know, who are trying to unwind and maybe, you know, help in some way the trauma being faced by younger generations?
I didn't really look into it that much. I probably should have looked into it more. I mean, those scenes of Lena and Matias playing together and kind of playing, you know, playing a game that they call FARC, like that was mm-hmm. kind of based from stuff in like my own childhood of like what we would play in the playground. And when you kind of look back on that as an adult, you're like, wow, that was kind of a really fucked up and weird thing to do. But, you know, it's like we're 7, 8 years old in like 1992, 1993. You're just kind of like acting out like what you hear in the news and like what you hear, you know, in the house, in school and your parents. And so, yeah, I'm sure like a therapist could have like a field day kind of like unpacking that. But yeah, I mean, I don't have the source, unfortunately, but I did find, I can't remember if it was an article or like a book of pictures that children had drawn, like children who'd been affected by paramilitary violence. And so obviously, like, I found that very affecting to see. A lot of the dialogue of the interactions with the Anthill children is based on firsthand stuff that I've heard people say in Colombia, some from like Mexico too, but yeah, just like in terms of using fiction as a way to kind of process a personal experience. Like a big part of this book was also just trying to like process the work I used to do of like working with kids and working in education. And I guess just like trying to work through that, I suppose. But yeah, I find like the way like children use like games, the kind of like ritual of playing a game, to be really rich and full of potential for writing.
Definitely. And finally, we're winding this down and you can get back to grading your papers.
On the edge of my seat all this time.
Yeah, you know, it's putting red, you know, I hope you got lots of red pens and so on. I don't know. Yeah. Is it still all done in paper?
Yeah.
There is this finally, again, another thing that really, really impacted me is I am writing less and less as a journalist these days because it's what happens. But there's your references to US evangelical volunteers going to the Hacienda Napolis theme park. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this actually generates such an issue with Carolina that she vomits. And I want to vomit too. The theme. I'm hoping you didn't hear anyone talk about it as a theme park.
I can't remember if that was like based on something I heard or not, but yeah, my sister, she likes to say that, wow, like this book is so bitchy. You wrote such a book. And I'm like, yeah, I think bitchy is a good term to describe it. I mean, my US publishers my US editor was saying that it kind of reminded her of Parasite, this Korean film. In terms of like this caustic class commentary, which, you know, is obviously like very flattering to me. But yeah, I mean, like in terms of that scene where she throws up all over herself after hearing these evangelicals talk with glee and delight about going to like Escobar's ranch and calling it an amusement park. I mean, that's, you know, a pretty obviously, you know, social commentary part of the book, I suppose, where, yeah, I mean, I was talking earlier how I think that traveling and like encountering different cultures and encountering different languages and just different experiences of the world and, you know, different minds other than like your own and like your own culture is so essential. And I tell that to my students all the time, that if they have an opportunity to travel, to learn another language, to like live and work in another country for a sustained period of time and like engage with the culture there, you know, I think that's something that is so beneficial for any person. But, you know, I mean, I used to work for a religious, they were like a Catholic organization that organized service trips. And there were some really beautiful and like good things about it. And there were some not so good things about it. So yeah, but I don't know how much love or affection I have in my heart for like these so-called like Christian evangelical groups kind of spreading the gospel. I mean, it's like, I'm kind of like rambling here, but it's like, I think like the main anger in that scene comes from me reading this book about like the development of oil in like the Colombian and Ecuadorian Amazon and how it was primarily Christian, like evangelical missionaries who kind of helped the oil companies like make the inroads to develop the Amazon for oil. And I was just like, that's such an unchristian thing to do. Like what shitty, horrible people. So I, you know, I mean, I was raised Catholic, but I'm not anymore. So I'm not, I there's some really problematic things with organized religion and the effect that it's had on Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I don't think many people can dispute that. So yeah. So that little scene where she vomits over her shoes, that's just kind of a climatic moment of just like, I can't really take this anymore, I suppose.
You and me both have our questions with the man when it comes to organized religion. Unfortunately, my wife is outside the room and can't hear me saying that. But that said, I don't think it's a bitchy book. I don't think you're sort of, you've got the hatchet out on this one. But then, you know, which is interesting to me, but I guess I live in Bogota and I look at, you know, Colombia in a different way from Bogota, and I go up to the coast a lot and so on. But interesting that your sister should say it's such a bitchy book.
I think she meant it affectionately. Okay.
But she lives in Medellin as well, so she's got to have some sort of pride towards the city in which she lives. Sure. So maybe. I think you're doing a service in explaining and exploring these different class divides and how extreme it is here in Colombia. I don't think you're doing something that's going to get you in a lot of trouble. I hope it doesn't get you in trouble. I don't think it will get you in any trouble.
I don't think it will. I think like I'm happy with how the book kind of interrogates Lena's position as a new volunteer, because I think like self-reflecting and, you know, self-interrogation is like an important thing to do. I mean, like, for example, like Stephen Miller, like the time he was in, you know, someone went up to him in like a Mexican restaurant and was just like, fuck you, Stephen Miller, you're making all these anti-immigrant policies and then you're going to have dinner in like a Mexican restaurant. Like, do you not see the hypocrisy there? So yeah, like self-interrogation and like self-reflection are two important qualities to have. And I think that's part of Lena's journey in this book, to not just kind of do what makes her feel comfortable and like what makes her feel good about herself, but to actually kind of think reflectively. I mean, to put it like bluntly, of like how to be a good ally, right? Like how to be a good ally.
Well, I think, I mean, we have to wind it down there. And I just want to say thank you so much for your time and coming back on the show. Guys, no, definitely my pleasure. And everyone, buy the book. Buy the book, The Ant Hill, Julianne Pacheco. Her website, juliannepacheco.com. Of course, it'll be on our Facebook page. Find her on Twitter. Tell her what you think. That's at Julianne Pacheco. And it's been really fun. It's been really cool to talk this. And I have to say, I love the cover artwork. I think it's great.
Oh, yeah. I love it, too.
Yeah, I think it's really... I think they've done a really good job, and I wish you all the best with the reviews and the sales for this book. And of course, it'd be interesting to see what your next one will be about. Will you finally steer away from Columbia, or has it had too much of an effect on you that this is something that's going to inspire and influence you forever? But thank you again. I really enjoyed it, and I hope one day our paths will cross in person.
I hope so too.
So we'll leave you there, and you can get back to grading your papers there in the outskirts of Norwich in Great Britain. Please stay safe, stay well. All of you out there as well, stay safe. Heed the warnings, be careful. I've been Richard McCall talking to Julianne Pacheco, author of The Ant Hill, author of The Lucky Ones. And yes, please keep listening. We've got great people lined up over the coming weeks, and we've been doing some great interviews. I know you all enjoyed last week's with Emma Louise Jay in her isolation in Antioquia, and prior to that, journalist Nadia Drost and her three-part series on crossing the Darien Gap with the migrants. So again, it's been fun, it's been lockdown, but keep listening. Thank you again, and bye bye.
La playa.